said this. He said that something wrong was with Aunt Maddie.
Mm-hmm.
And Admiral King apparently had the naval doctors come in. It was almost as he described in the scene, as I said, he went into the dining room, which must have been like a boardroom.
Mm-hmm.
And he was sitting at one side.
That was
King. This is Admiral King, and he brought in the naval doctors. But at the same time, he wasn't going to let them handle the case. He was going to make all the decisions. So he called for his nephew to get over from Baltimore because he wanted him there for his opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as I recall your father saying, that the naval doctors gave their opinion on what should be done. And he turned over and said, Stuart, now I'm going to ask you, what would you do in this case? And Stuart said, I gave some sort of opinion. And he said, the Admiral listened to everyone's opinion. And he said, he made the decision what should be done with Aunt Maddie. He wasn't allowing any doctor to make the decision. He wanted the facts.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked his nephew, and I think his nephew agreed he would do something differently. And I think he said, Stuart, I think you're right.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we're going to do it this way. And that's what he told him to do. And I was always impressed with that story. They had enough interest to come over and take charge,
mm-hmm.
a complete operation, and it took several hours. It wasn't really something he did in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But he did not say to the doctor, well, you know best, you do best. He made the decision.
There was another person there who we met who was Joe's closest friend. His name was Ballantyne, better known as Bally Jr., they called him. And we met young Bally a couple years ago, and he told us that essentially what you've just told me. He said that was the first time, he said, I never really got to see Admiral King, and he said he could see him, how his mind worked, and how he attacked the problem, and how he looked at the various alternatives, and how he finally came to the decision, this is the way it was going to be. But it was King mustering the whole family and all the experts he could get, listening to everybody say what they had to say, and then him saying, this way we're going to do it. And young Joe's best friend, said he'd never forgotten that. Because he could see King's mind at work when that was happening.
But it is unusual, because most people let the doctors decide.
Yeah. He was going to make that decision. But you had another story now. Was that the story that you wanted to tell me? No, there's another one.
I wanted you to hear.
Well,
I will mention this, which is a little bit of a side, but I think he was so close with Uncle Walter that was very rather important in his life. But it is interesting now, my grandfather was a Episcopalian, I'm sure Aunt Maddie was,
mm-hmm.
and her sister Florrie, who married
mm-hmm.
Uncle Walter,
mm-hmm.
was an Episcopalian. But Uncle Walter and Aunt Florrie went, I believe, to the Philippines.
Canal,
is that it?
Mm-hmm.
But the only people who went to church were the Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
And she was very devout, so she became a Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, was still married to a Protestant, but consequently, all of her children are Catholic. So there's now a tremendous Catholic branch there,
mm-hmm.
and people, you know, a little confused sometimes because why all these Episcopalians have so many Catholics
mm-hmm.
and relatives,
mm-hmm.
and that's why we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you have any other notes there?
I know that covered all. You.
Well, I recall this to give you the sense of things. And Kitty and I were married. Of course, the matriarch was her grandmother, Edgerton.
Mm-hmm.
And she insisted that the family arrive. And she always talked to me because she's, you know, very frank in what she wanted. There was no...
Now, which one is this?
Your grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
So she told me that she would have Admiral King there. And I stalked all this, but she was very serious.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when the ushers were there and the guest list were handing out the seats were reserved for Admiral. He did not show,
mm-hmm.
but she simply said that the family will gather for this occasion, and I think...
Yeah, I can't remember who did come, but most of the time.
Your Uncle Walter showed up. They did show up. I mean, they
mm-hmm.
were...
Mm-hmm.
They came, but she told me that Admiral King... I said to him, well, he's obviously busy. Listen.
Well,
he will be here, but he didn't come, so I never did ask him what.
Well, I'll tell you another story on my grandmother, only in that it tells you the generation of the man. My grandmother, I say we adored her, she was so family oriented, but she didn't really make an awful lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
Everything she said at least twice.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, your mind would wander and so forth. and you say, you know, why didn't these people go to college and all? Maybe they weren't intellectuals. But at one time, a certain incident occurred that So the grandmother really was very shrewd, and when it really came right down to it, she had a lot of stuff. There was a brother in the family, Uncle Sam, my grandfather's partner, and Uncle Sam's wife died. Well, after a while, he took up with the person the family knew of as that woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember hearing that my grandfather used to go to business in his own car with a chauffeur. He had too much of a temper, he couldn't drive, so he had to be.
Mm-hmm.
But one time, I guess my grandfather and Uncle Sam were in the chauffeur-driven car and they came out. And my grandmother went out and said, all right, to my grandfather, you leave, the chauffeur leave. And she got in the car and talked to Uncle Sam. And she didn't really talk about that woman, but said, you must leave your money to your children. And really laid it on the line. In no uncertain times, and this is this old lady, a little fuddy-duddy person who never seemed to make an awful lot of sense and wore black hair.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she made him promise, and he did fulfill the promise that
mm-hmm.
he made to her.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes these little old ladies fool you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe Aunt Maddie was the same kind too.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just say another thing. Your grandmother told me one time. You know, her mind really didn't have that range and didn't get things clear. But she said that Admiral King was terribly upset on the raising of the submarine up at
Portsmouth.
Terribly upset. I guess it was Monson. Was it Monson who claimed the credit or something?
There was some squabbles over who was supposed to get credit for the thing, yes.
Apparently he was terribly upset about this, because he apparently commanded the whole operation.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently made all the major decisions. And I guess when they started wrapping up the operation, Monson was written the article claiming all the credit, which he didn't think belonged to him. I think was a point she made to me. And I had read about the raising of the squabbles, and I never didn't know he was there. I thought this other man was there.
Well, Monson was, of course, the one who came up with so-called Monson Lung, which would allow a submariner to put a air breathing device on, which would allow him the chance of survival after he went into the airlock in the submarine escape hatch. Then he opened it up by using the Monson Lung, that it would give a trapped submariner a better chance to escape. That's the first thing that comes to my mind about Monson.
Well, something about the whole operation,
yeah.
He felt, where he didn't apparently publicize it, he felt credit was all his. He had commanded and done all the thinking and so forth, and somebody else would find out the credit. Other thing I'd heard about him, that he was very forward-looking
mm-hmm.
in the Navy. He started being what you'd call the black shoe Navy. He had also gotten himself trained in submarines. He got himself trained in aviation at a time when he didn't have those qualifications in the Navy.
One of the more amusing stories is how he went charging into the submarine service, and King was very strong on his own ideas, and when he wanted something done, he didn't listen to objections. He just bullet right on through, and he really did not have that good a concept on how to use submarines. He tried to handle submarines like you handle a group of surface ships, and he had them flying signal pennants and doing formations and all that business, and the submariners felt that he really didn't appreciate what those submarines were supposed to be doing. But I've gotten quite a few wonderful letters from submariners who remember when he was in command of the submarine base at New London, and how he ran it while he was there, and a couple of real good sea stories,
yeah,
too, about King and the submarines. And then, of course, I've got umpteen letters about King as an aviator. And it's interesting how accurate you can get stories from aviators, because see, aviators always keep their own private log. The aviator can tell you to a tenth of an hour how many hours they have flown since the day they first went solo. And every time an aviator goes up for anything at all, he will always keep his logbook, that where he will record what plane he took and what the mission was and who his passengers were, see. And when these guys retire, they take their logbooks with them. And so when I would write to an officer who perhaps was King's flight instructor when King, as a Navy captain at age 47, was trying to learn how to fly. This fellow could go to his log and with great clarity tell you precisely what airplane he was in, when he flew it, how well King did, and where they took off from and where they landed. So it's amazing that the accurate feedback that I've gotten from the naval aviators on King.
Good.
On King,
very
yeah.
Good. Some of them even write back and say to Tom, I'm going to check my logbook on that.
Well, that's here, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, what you really say he kept them all these years. Because most of these people are in their 80s. So
well, Tom Reed and I got the dates mixed up. I've got 6 Tom and Joe Keeman is out at home. Apparently I don't think Joe was ever close to his father.
Why do you say that?
Well, because apparently when the father was in Portsmouth in the hospital, Joe went up to spend a lot of time with him. I think they knew that the father was not going to recover.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this seems to be the thinking is coming to me occasionally. So Joe went up there quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe said to me at the time, he'd gotten all the papers, and he was going to write a book on his father.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that's about the time he's thinking about getting out of the Navy.
Joe retired on 20, I know.
On 20?
On 20, yeah.
So he'd be around, he graduated, what, 45?
45.
Mm-hmm.
So he got around 65.
Right.
Well, this was in 60, 61, and he had told me how he'd gone up and spent considerable time. Now, he must have gotten off from duty to do it. And I believe stayed in the hospital in a room where he could talk to his father during the day. And I think he was telling me how much he'd gotten to know his father in
mm-hmm.
this time.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to me he'd not really known his father because he'd grown up during the war years when his father was busy.
Yeah.
That would be my guess.
That would be a good guess. That was the impression. That was the impression that I had, too. An interesting story it's not a story. It's what I've gotten out of something that Admiral King wrote himself, and I'm still, again, going back to the Edgerton King courtship, as it were, that King was away from her. Must have been up there, at least 2 years, maybe longer. Because he, when he left the academy, he immediately went to sea. Did not come back to Annapolis, did not come back to Baltimore. Went aboard a ship called USS Cincinnati in about 1902-1903. In the Cincinnati, he picked up on the East Coast, took it all the way through the Mediterranean, to the Suez Canal, to the Indian Ocean, and then he was on China Station during the 1904 Russo-Japanese War. So he was gone from the States at least two years. And then he came back and had orders to ship on the East Coast, I think so, and announced that on the way back that he had some business at West Point. And he came back and married Maddie after being away from her for over 2 years. And coming right straight off sea duty. And that's interesting too. That's interesting too, because that meant that they were writing to each other. And that there must have been some proposals made and proposals accepted while he was gone. Because when he came back from China Station, he knew he was going to marry her. Then his father died. Something happened right after he got to West Point. The marriage ceremony was postponed just a short time, several weeks or so. And then he came back, married Maddie, and then went right back sea again. And so they must have written to each other. They must have written to each other. These are the things that when you know where they were and you try to piece together just what it was that happened.
Deductions that we made from that,
because
you said that he was such an intelligent man, you have no idea how she did.
Mm-hmm.
So
this
couldn't have been too bad.
Yeah. Well,
he came back here
I remember also I asked Joe why he thought they got married, and Joe implied rather emphatically he had always heard in the family that Maddie knew she was always going to marry Ernest King, and that it was always his feeling that she had her eye on Ernest King, and she made up her mind she was going to marry Ernest King. On the other hand, I've heard from other sources that She was, again, because she was so beautiful, so attractive, so lively, and because she was looked upon as being the Belle of Baltimore, as it were, that Ernest King wanted only the best because, see, he was, while he was there, he was the number one midshipman. It was called only the battalion, and they only had a battalion of midshipmen, but he was a battalion commander. He was the highest ranking midshipman officer there at the Naval Academy, and he stood something like number three or four in his class overall. And he would just say number one. I mean, he was king of the Naval Academy while he was there, you see. And so you get almost the feeling that he looked upon Martha as being looked upon Maddie as being the most beautiful, the most desirable, that everybody looked upon her as being the ultimate and a beautiful Baltimore woman. And so that was what made her attractive to him. And she looked upon him as this tall, handsome, strapping, fun-loving midshipman who was the number one midshipman at the Naval Academy, and perhaps they looked upon each other as being the best you could possibly have, and they came together that way. That's the sort of thing I'm trying to piece together, but I don't know for sure, see, and that's why I keep asking. And
well, of course, what was the time limit imposed upon midshipmen before they were permitted to marry?
Pretty long. They were past midshipmen for 2 years. They could not even get their commission as ensign until 2 years after graduating. So that, of course, was a hindrance. If they could get married after that, I'm not sure. I know for years at the Naval Academy, there's a law that they cannot marry until 3 years after graduation, for example. The theory being that a young officer ought to concentrate on learning his way at sea and that a wife would only be a distraction. Only be a distraction to them.
Well, they had that here till what, 1941?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. They had nothing to do with the sea. They didn't think they could afford to be married.
Yeah.
Well, let me just say one thing. I think my knowledge is very small, but I don't. One thing about the daughters, and the only three I really know are Mildred and Martha and Florrie. Perhaps mm-hmm. Florrie, best of all, and Martha. And
mm-hmm.
not just Florrie, then. Neither, when you met them, they never talked about their father.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was never that's never came up in conversation. By mm-hmm. any reference whatsoever, would it say, well, let me tell you about my father. Never, that was one subject you never even ran across. And Joe never started talking about his father, basically, until that time around 66. One, when he was telling me about being with his father a lot in Oxford. Mm-hmm. We had seen Joe up here when he came up to visit when he lived in North Park, back up in 15, something like that. You never know who he was. Never spent a time talking. So.
What was your impression of Mrs. King's personality and her interest in what type of person she was?
She grew heavy in her later years. Yeah. She was
smoked a great deal too, didn't she? Smoked?
No, I don't recall it.
I bet she gave that up and she had a heart attack then because she had that heart attack. Yeah. You know.
See, I didn't know. I never saw her.
Mm-hmm. Once she was.
She had a heart attack and was taken to the hospital. And what Bethesda, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It was a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
Which was, you would have known her after.
Yes, she did not.
Yes,
right?
But I think I knew from a distance that she had had.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I don't remember her.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would say that, as I said to you, I never knew Kitty, and I never knew she was related to
mm-hmm.
King. And I heard all these talks, but just like a young person reading. But I do recall the days when Roosevelt was, and being a young cadet here, that
mm-hmm.
King was chief of naval operations, of course, when I was there.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. King was seldom if ever in the pictures, and then one time she was in the picture, and I remember they said she had such awful hats. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I think she met the Queen of England in a
tall
hat with a pretty
big brim. It just came out, as I recall that story passing. So if you, but that would be her character when I met
mm-hmm.
her, that she was heavy,
mm-hmm.
there's no doubt about it. And she was a family person.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you mean by a family person?
Well, she never said anything other than the family.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was no conversation. You never said, let me tell you about Ernest. Never in it. It was never
mm-hmm.
like Ernest this or Ernest
mm-hmm.
never that.
Mm-hmm.
She never used those words. She was just a very sweet person, and she'd say, well, tell me what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you'd tell her what you're doing, and she didn't tell you about the family problems, or she'd laugh about something. And I remember when Joe decided to put the azalea bushes all over that front house, and I thought that was rather strange.
Mm-hmm.
He covered it, he didn't want to mow the lawn.
He bought 90.
90 azalea bushes and planted them all over the front, you know. It came up some steps, but, you know, and it was difficult to mow it because of the configuration. We planted them all with azaleas. And they had a nice place out in back. He had been working and making a patio and a garden, and she sat out there a lot. And she'd said, but mostly when she's in the room, I was never there, just a single person, one-on-one, but always some member of the family would be opposite. And a chair next to her talking. You'd go up and say hello or something like that, and another family always went over to her and sat and chatted with her for a while. But she was quite the
matriarch. I think she had dogs.
Yeah. But she would come to them like you're sitting, Marilyn. She'd sit there, and there'd be chairs around, and people come up and talk to her for a while, and then move off, talk to the people. Other people would always come up, but nobody ever ignored her.
The real matriarch of the family, then.
Oh, absolutely. But when she did entertain, I guess they had cocktails, but she put a very good spread out. So, I mean, very good food, and I think probably maybe to somebody did. I don't know how what she actually did in the kitchen. Maybe the kids helped.
But the daughters were always very conscious of it. They're very good children, especially to their mother. And they rallied around her. That's all I can say. And when you talk to them, they never once...
there was no backbiting.
There was no fighting, and there was no... they had a lot of things that were kind of... I used to laugh about it, because Kitty sort of told you some of the stories. If you listen to her father, you don't know which side you're talking on, because they're very humorous. You see, some of the family stories are, and they have a lot of stories about their children and all. And you might hear some funny story about... talking about their kids, but they never talked about
Well, we know Johnny Eisenhower because he's a classmate of his. He doesn't sit down about his dad. And people are inclined not to.
On the other hand, I know what I might call the Navy families where well, like the McCains, for example, is one family, which one Navy family. Slew McCain was an admiral in World War II, and then Admiral McCain was sink pack for so very long right during the Vietnam War, and then his son, who was a classmate of mine, got shot down over Vietnam. Smedberg is another one. He had been superintendent of the Naval Academy. Now his son had just made admiral, his oldest son. You identify very strongly with them. Another family that comes to mind is the Mustin family. There's a third generation Mustin now in the Navy, and his father and his grandfather are admirals, and Hank Mustin's going to be an admiral. And I guess that there are some families where, by gosh, like the Pattons, for example. Now there's an Army family, one general officer after another, I suppose. But then on the other extreme, these are the sons who apparently can follow in the father's footsteps. Then you have others that just can't. And I guess that certainly he said my dad was very ambitious, and from the day he was a midshipman, he knew he wanted to be the number one admiral in the Navy.
Oh.
He said, I never had that ambition myself. He said, I just wanted a good time. He said, I was not a good student.
Very honest with him.
Well, what was his answer when we asked him why he wanted to go there?
He said, I really didn't know what else I wanted.
Well, his father wanted him to be a hard-charging naval officer. He certainly would have been, but it just wasn't Joel's personality. Now, could have been because Joel, well, for want of a better word, because he was a mother's boy. You'd think that maybe when you grow up, the only son and youngest child with six sisters.
And
the dad not around very much?
I recall somebody else, I recall from other conversation, maybe it's from Joe. Somebody asked Admiral for a favor. I know this one. I will.
Well, he's just somebody who asks a favor of everybody.
Another man. Not really his family. He wanted the admiral to do a favor for him. The admiral So I'm just saying that he wasn't afraid to say no. Mm-hmm. But no, let's just flesh the story. It's just somebody who went to Naval Academy, mm-hmm. also in the family,
mm-hmm.
that got out and spent all of his time doing specialized work like the communications officer. Mm-hmm. Never aided the admiral, but never mm-hmm. did any, never took command of a ship or anything, mm-hmm. and got up so far, and all of a sudden, the selection board said, this is as far as you go.
Mm-hmm.
And he was reclaiming he should be picked up and promoted because he'd been doing a good job all these mm-hmm. years, the greatest job in the world. But mm-hmm. the selection board said, no, you're through. So he fought it for years and years, and we always used to go up the admiral because he was related. The admiral said, drop dead.
I can hear it too.
And he's pretty quiet. Got a little family pressure through the women on this mm-hmm. too, because they, you know, I think we're cahoots. I will say this about Joe, because you've seen him now as mm-hmm. a mature man. But when I first met him, when he was approximately 14, 15, 16, but in that time frame, I met him in Baltimore, but they did live in Coronado. And I just thought he did the most daring things, because out there they could drive at age 14. Out in Baltimore you couldn't. But they not only drove, but they did. They played games in cars where you would drive to another car and you would rip the other car's finger off. But, you know, which sounds very, very daring and very horrifying.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very out of character with Joe, as you've seen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But apparently they did that and he just thought that was the greatest. I thought it was absolutely horrible.
Now,
fascinating.
That doesn't seem out of character.
From what Joe told us, he's very honest with himself, saying that all I really wanted to do was have a good time. But 14, that sort of destructive and dangerous, you could be hurt. But I think he suffered, maybe he said this, I think he suffered when he was in the Naval Academy for years, say four or five. He told us it was tough.
Undoubtedly, because he's other people with him, and we knew Lucian Truscott, the second one, he was a famous general, and then the second one, he was a generation, and he, as a young, let me finish my story, but he said, as a very young officer, he was in formation at Benning, and one or two generals came down and said, now which one's Truscott? And he was pointed out, they looked him up now and said, you don't have it. and it just, you know, it was sort of devastating. You know. And I think that, you know, famous fathers and sons have a hard time.
Well, I was just going to say, he was at a Naval Academy. He used to say his father came down for special functions. How many times, I don't know. Maybe for a commencement other times. And everybody was looking him over and his father. I think he did.
No.
His performance, I don't know. I don't think he was, you know, doing the things his father did.
Well, he told me that he was always the first one out in Annapolis on Saturday afternoons.
Undoubtedly.
And the last one in, and that...
Sometimes they have to live down the name, as opposed to being...
Right.
Every bit of gung-ho-ness is held against them.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to go the other way. But, you know, I'll mention this because I'm sure you know it, but I know the family was very proud of Uncle Ernest. After he had had his stroke, I think he lost the power of speech. And he apparently learned to talk again, which they thought was...
Yes, he had to go to Philadelphia.
You know, it was a real long, difficult, very difficult thing, so they were very long. And I did want to mention this. I do remember the Kings being very upset and incensed at, I believe it was either somebody in the Navy or an author, and you're talking about the squirrels raising, what is mine. Was there a man named Ellsworth? Ellsberg.
It's either Ellsberg
or
Ellsworth.
And I think perhaps he wrote either about the
Monson, he was mad. It was Ellsberg.
Yes, because they were, that's the one that they...
Ellsberg apparently wrote and claimed credit for raising the squalor.
And I think that he...
And they said that the admiral got upset about that?
Yes, got very upset about
that. Okay.
Because also when we're hearing the family upset, they're...
Yeah, they were just reflecting.
I feel like I'm going through analysis because you haven't been thinking about these. Pardon? That was the law. I guess I got the words mixed up because maybe Monson wasn't even there. Maybe he just invented the device and it was called the Ellsberg that did the writing, and they were very upset. And I think that maybe he had written another book or two, and maybe Uncle Ernest has been mentioned and wasn't, but they were really down on him.
Well, you've both have certainly been a great help to me, and perhaps you found it interesting to see how a biographer goes around trying to find out things about people, and I, when I talk with people who know the subjects, who knew the person I'm interested in, or knew the family, I'm just so intensely interested in every little scrap of information that I can possibly find.
And I don't think we've shed much light.
Well, you never know. You see, what I have to do is just get these little scraps and the little pieces, and then we start putting it all together, you see. And that's what makes it so fascinating, because you never know.